From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the not-so-wide-open West, we talk with Timothy Egan about his New York Times series on urban sprawl in boom cities of the West and how it's brought traffic jams, air pollution, and other problems people came to escape. Egan says Las Vegas, Phoenix, and Denver are suffering from unchecked growth, but Portland, Oregon, which adopted strict guidelines in the 70s, has become the model for a new kind of city. Also, we consider an earlier romance with the West when homesteaders were lured to eastern Montana by what we'd now think of as advertising hype. We talk with Jonathan Rabin about his new book, Badland. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new tribute to Gene Ammons by Ellery Eskelin. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The Supreme Court is deciding whether terminally ill people have the constitutional right to doctor-assisted suicide. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The Clinton administration will be siding with opponents of doctor-assisted suicide, as are many other organizations such as the American Medical Association. But there are an equal number on the other side. Privately, advocates of doctor-assisted suicide are not optimistic about their chances in the Supreme Court. They know how severely the court has been criticized for its abortion decisions, and even many scholars who support the right to abortion believe the court went too fast, creating a broad right before it was necessary and displacing a reform movement that was just beginning in state legislatures. Now, once again, the court is being asked to make a broad declaration at a time that advances in modern medical technology have provoked people into rethinking how they end their lives. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Senate hearings began today on the nomination of Madeleine Albright to be Secretary of State. The current U.N. ambassador presented a prepared statement to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, pledging to give the nation first-class diplomacy if she gets the job. If she does, and it's very likely she will hold the highest office ever held by a woman in U.S. history. The government of Peru is pledging to continue contact with the Tupac Amaru rebels despite an apparent deadlock in the hostage crisis at the Japanese ambassador's residence. John Miller reports from Lima.
Peru's prime minister says the government will continue what he called unofficial dealings with the rebels in an effort to bring the standoff to a peaceful end. The only time the official government negotiator has met with the hostage takers was nearly 2 weeks ago, prompting the rebels to complain that the government was not serious about ending the crisis. Most communication between the two sides so far has been through the news media. Yesterday, President Alberto Fujimori took reporters on a whirlwind tour of a Lima shantytown and of a prison where some Tupac Amaru members are being held. The rebels, meanwhile, played host to two journalists from the Japanese television network Asahi. The journalists snuck into the residence and spent 2 hours there. They were detained by police when they left. Japan's prime minister strongly criticized the journalists for threatening the negotiation process. For National Public Radio, I'm John Miller in Lima.
Richard Branson came back down to Earth early this morning. The British tycoon wanted to be the first person to circle the globe in a balloon. He had technical problems less than 24 hours after he took off, and the balloon put down abruptly in the Algerian desert. Branson and his co-pilot were not hurt. On Wall Street this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 13.09 points at 6587.57 in heavy trading of 252 million shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index is up 1.18 points at 1328.91. You're listening to National Public Radio News. In NPR's business update, Media General has completed its $710 million purchase of Park Acquisitions Incorporated by selling 62 newspapers and exchanging a Virginia television station for two others in the Southeast. Media General has spent $1 billion on acquisitions in the past year. Dun & Bradstreet has been tracking business relocations. It finds that more firms are abandoning New York and California for the South Atlantic and Mountain States. UPI's Ed Silk reports.
The Dun & Bradstreet survey finds that between 1991 and 1995, more than 56,000 business firms crossed state lines to relocate, taking more than 1 million jobs with them. Of those firms, nearly 4,000 relocated to the South Atlantic states, giving that region a net gain of about 72,000 jobs. Georgia had the highest net job gain in the region. The Mountain States had a net gain of about 37,000 jobs, with Colorado accounting for about one-third. The big losers were New York and California, which each lost more than 3,000 businesses and more than 75,000 jobs in the five-year period. Dun & Bradstreet economists say the key motives for relocating were lowering the cost of doing business and raising the quality of the labor pool. I'm Ed Silk.
If you bought the latest computer with the most up-to-the-minute technology for Christmas this year, your purchase is already outdated. Intel Corporation today launched its Pentium chip with multimedia extension technology, promising TV-quality video, stereo surround sound, and three-dimensional graphics. Intel said that its new chip will provide real-time animation and a better internet experience. I'm Nora Rahm, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for this program comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve health and health care for all Americans.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The most popular cities in the American West are swollen with people who came in search of a better quality of life, to live closer to nature, and to have better air. These new cities had hoped to avoid the unchecked suburban sprawl that characterized cities in California like Los Angeles. But now some of the new urban West is becoming its own worst nightmare, with bad air alerts, traffic congestion, and the loss of open space. This is what Timothy Egan reported on in his recent New York Times series on urban sprawl in the West. Egan is the Times' Pacific Northwest bureau chief, and he's a third-generation resident of the West. His series focused on six of the 15 fastest-growing metropolitan areas in the nation: Seattle, Portland, Phoenix, Las Vegas, Denver, and Salt Lake City. His series was filled with amazing facts. For instance, the West is the area with the highest percentage of people living in urban areas.
It's amazing when you consider the mythology and just and the contemporary idea as well of the West, which is open spaces. We go there because of public lands. But in fact, 86% of the people in the West live in cities. And one of the many kind of fun facts that my editors on the overcrowded island of Manhattan got a kick out of was the fact that Utah, with 2 million people, is a more urban area than New York State, with 20-plus million people.
Amazing. Another interesting fact, Castle Rock in Douglas County, Colorado, is the fastest-growing county in America, but it may go broke. Why might it go broke?
Yeah, that's an amazing thing. Castle Rock itself is okay. They're sort of teetering, but the county there is called Douglas County, and that's where you have the famous Highlands Ranch, which is 10,000 homes on its way to 50,000 homes. They're sort of interchangeable looking. To me, they sort of looked like, you know, Dorothy's home when it lands after going through the hurricane. Imagine 10,000 of those homes all landing, all having three bedrooms, being sort of a beige, non-offensive color, all having cedar decks, and all in this place where people go because they want to have good schools and open space, and they want to flee the urban ills. But ironically, they're in a county now that has the lowest per capita support for their schools because they've got this tax structure that was supposed to be designed to attract folks to begin with, is bankrupting them.
What is it about the tax structure in this county that threatens to bankrupt it?
Well, let's say that 10,000 people come to this county in 3 months, which is almost their pace of growth right now. And those 10,000 people all have to pay property taxes. Those property taxes go to build schools and to help with the basic infrastructure. Well, they have a law which the Republicans passed in their state about 4 or 5 years ago that says, as your tax revenue comes in, you have to reduce the taxes on everyone else so that the overall pot of tax money remains the same. So you never really get any more money from all these people coming in. All it does is bring pressure on those people trying to build schools, those people trying to build roads. Every new person essentially puts you deeper into debt.
Another interesting fact from your series on the new American West, and that is the fastest growing city in America is Las Vegas. But of course, Las Vegas is built on the inhospitable desert. So what are the problems in Las Vegas now?
Well, Vegas is in the middle of the Mojave Desert. The Mojave Desert gets 4 inches of rain a year. Now, Las Vegas had these little artesian wells that sort of burbled up out of the ground, and there were a couple of Paiute Indians that used to come down in the summer and gather around and get water and make mash out of mesquite trees and then retreat back up into the mountains. The Mormons tried to build a settlement there where they thought they could gouge travelers on the way from traveling from Salt Lake to California. That failed. And finally, what came about was this pipeline from the Colorado River to the valley, and they figured as long as we could suck water out of the Colorado River, we could build a city here. Now, it didn't really mean much until the late 1980s when Southern California started to empty out en masse. And Vegas became sort of the ultimate California suburb. It's only 280 miles from California. But you look at it, and it is absolutely reaching its limit. Now, Saudi Arabia hasn't done any better than people in America have at building a massive city in a place that gets 0 to 4 inches of rain. They are running out of water in Las Vegas. They'll be maxed out in less than 10 years. And they're building homes at the rate of better than one home every 45 minutes. I mean, Vegas sort of is the epitome of the Edward Abbey line, where he said that the philosophy of unfettered growth is the philosophy of the cancer cell. And you can look at Vegas and watch it just spreading hour by hour, acre by acre. There's nobody saying no, because that goes against sort of the grain of what's keeping everything on a high right there now.
And there's nobody saying, no, sorry, there's not enough water to support these.
Well, they tried that, Terry. In 1991, they had a brief moratorium. They realized they were running out of water, and they had a moratorium. And the town just went nuts. They said, no, we can't do that. We have to continue to create Venice, which is the next city they're going to create on the Vegas Strip, or create New York, New York. I mean, you have this wonderful irony right now where they're building the old cities of the world on the Strip. New York, New York opened this month, complete with the Hudson River out front and the tugboats. And the next big project is to create Venice, complete with canals and all of that. Now, while on the Strip, they're creating New York, New York, Venice, and Paris is on the books as well. Around the Strip, they are creating sort of L.A. circa the Blade Runner era. So you have this fascinating thing going up around it. Most people don't know, but almost all of Vegas now is outside of the city limits, so they can't tax any of these subdivisions. They have all these gated communities built, by the way, on the Howard Hughes model. Hughes was the first visionary of the gated community. Remember, Hughes came to Vegas and he holed up in the Desert Inn, and he never opened his blinds for the 9 years that he lived in this suite, and he had this perfectly climate-controlled room in the middle of the Mojave Desert. Well, Hughes also had this idea to build a residential community that somewhat matched his neuroses. And so now you have the fastest-growing areas in Vegas are these guarded, climate-controlled communities named things like Harbor Vista. Harbor is spelled H-A-R-B-O-U-R. Mariner's Cove, which is a place we should have here in Seattle. Green Valley, Somerset Heights, you know, all these sort of old English green 40 inches of rain kind of places. They're all gated. They're all climate controlled. They have artificial lakes, and it's all from just utterly draining and sucking out their groundwater in the Colorado River. Well, now they're at a peak, and they've got nothing to do except for go to the rest of the seven states in the West and say, look, we've maxed out our water supply. We're the fastest growing city in America. What are you going to do about it? Are you going to let us die of thirst? So their idea is that they can just sort of present themselves, and that the law of the river, the Colorado River Pact, will have to be entirely rewritten to match them.
Timothy Egan is my guest, and he's a New York Times bureau chief in the Pacific Northwest. You know, it's ironic. You know, a lot of people moved out to the Arizona desert for respiratory conditions. Their doctor told them they'd breathe better there. And now in the suburbs of Phoenix, for instance, people are warned to stay indoors on bad air days if they have respiratory problems.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, one of the oldest things of the arid West, starting before the turn of the century, is go west to improve your health. And people would come out here and they'd say, my God, I feel better already. And they live 30, 40 years past the time they were supposed to die, because whether it was an effect of thinking they were feeling better or the air itself. But now they have these air alerts, not just in Phoenix, which is, you know, where all these snowbirds are, but they have them in Salt Lake City, which will host the 2002 Olympics. They have them in Denver, and they have them in Las Vegas. So in addition to the next day's weather forecast, you hear this thing about tomorrow's going to be unhealthful in the afternoon. We advise most children under the age of 10 and most people over the age of 60 not to go outside. And you'll hear that right after the five-day forecast, which is for 5 days of 65-degree weather. But you can't do anything about it.
To sum up, how would you describe the typical city in the new urban West?
The typical city in the new urban West is like a teenager who's 17 years old, is great-looking, can run the 100-yard dash in 9.2 seconds, thinks they will never die, thinks they will never age, thinks that they're just invulnerable. These cities are all set in spectacular areas. whether it's the Sonoran Desert, which I love, or the Rocky Mountains, which I also love, or Puget Sound or the Willamette Valley, which is where I'm from. I'm a third generation Westerner, so I consider myself someone who would never leave this area ever. But these cities, because they're set in such beautiful areas, they've got this sort of disease that a really good-looking teenager has. They think they will never get wrinkles, as I said. And so they think they cannot repeat these mistakes.
What are some of the situations that led to the problems that these new American cities in the West have? Let's start with the role of developers. Do you see them as being among the more guilty parties?
Well, I don't really want to put a moral value on developers. They just do what they do, which is to build homes and try to do whatever they have to do legally to get around the local county commissioner so they can keep building homes, sell them for a 20 or 30% profit, then move on to the next scratch of open land and build more homes. If you want to look around at guilty parties, you can look at the people who were elected to try to do something about these cities. Now, we can talk a little bit about Portland later. There is a pattern that all of these cities follow, and it goes like this. It starts with the grand vision. We will be something different. We're set in a great place. We're destined to be different because we're made up of people who came from bad places. Therefore, we're gonna not repeat the mistakes. So you hear a lot of talk, for example, here in Seattle, of creating Paris on Puget Sound. You hear a lot of talk in Salt Lake City of the great, you know, first great American city of the new century, so they'll have their 2002 Olympics. So they start with a great plan of being terrific. But then the common pattern is they have these balkanized governments where 27 little cities and suburbs are all making decisions. So there's no grand vision ever put on the place. There's grand visionary rhetoric that always comes out that says we won't repeat the mistakes, but there's no grand political plan. So you have the classic pattern of developers going into whatever jurisdiction has to be massaged, to use the euphemism. And that can be a county, that can be a town government, that can be a planning agency. And they just do what they have to do to get the permits to move on to the next scratch of open land. And only one city of these six that I looked at, Portland, has tried to say from the start, no, we're going to speak with one political plan. We're going to enforce a urban growth boundary around every city in this state. We're going to say this far and no more. So I think the pattern is you start feeling terrific, but it breaks down in the political structure because you have these balkanized 27, 35 little individual governments. Another thing I should mention, though, is that for a long time, cities like Salt Lake, Denver, and Phoenix were sort of modest towns with, I guess you could say, much to be modest about. And they went through terrible recessions. Phoenix had the great SNL bust. Salt Lake City had the mining bust, and Denver, of course, had the energy boom that went bust as well. They also had SNL problems. And so what they did in the early 80s was to try to attract as many people as they could by having these really great tax structures and by letting down their guard on sprawl and by loosening these impact fees that they were charging developers and by basically saying, okay, we've got to create a new economy here. How do we do it? Well, we'll try to bring in these new clean companies. And the irony is, Terry, that like in Denver, for example, this new boom is not built on tearing down the Rockies. I mean, in the 80s, you had all these shale companies and all these oil companies going in and just literally ripping open the seams in the mountains. Now Denver is this sort of clean industry center. It's TCI cable, it's telecommunications. But while they're not tearing open the Rockies, they're committing the worst mistakes that cities can make according to, you know, folks who look at these things and say, what should we not do?
My guest is Timothy Egan, the New York Times Pacific Northwest Bureau Chief. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Timothy Egan, and he's the Pacific Northwest Bureau Chief for the New York Times. He's actually just starting a six-month leave to complete a book. You say the city that did it right is Portland, and you date that back to the 1970s when Portland drew a line around the metropolitan area. What was the line for?
Well, they had a Republican governor named Tom McCall, great, tall, lanky, sort of Lincoln-esque figure. There are statues in his honor already around the state of Oregon. And McCall liked to go around and say he loved Oregon more than life itself. And, you know, he was the person who made the famous statement, come visit Oregon, but for God's sake, don't come and live here. He really tapped into sort of the Northwest xenophobia in the sense that the main thing they fear is Californians. And so he got a thing that passed through his legislature in the mid-1970s, and it was an absolutely revolutionary law for the United States because we're one of the countries where it values private property rights almost more than anything. And this law simply said that every city of any size in the state of Oregon had to come up with an urban growth boundary, essentially just a line. They just had to go out there and draw a line and say this far and no more. On one side of the line would be the city and all that the city represents. On the other side would be orchards, forests, vineyards, just open space, mountains, anything. So when you go down to Portland, you're really struck by the fact, now here's a vibrant, fast-growing, hugely prosperous, wonderful, gleaming, polished new American city with about 1.5 million people in its metro area. And you can go 9 miles from the center of town, and you're strolling in these sort of Tuscan vineyards. You know, Oregon makes a terrific Pinot Noir, if you've never had it. A little plug for their wines. Or you're strolling in these pear orchards, or you're walking along a forested path. And you're on this, in this part of Oregon that looks like Oregon maybe looked like 200, 300 years ago. Developers just went ape over the thing. They three times brought a measure before the voters to try to roll it back, and three times the voters in the state of Oregon all voted to keep the urban growth boundary. There were lawsuits. It's gone to several courts. But the thing is held. It's worked. And polls show that 80% of the people in Oregon love it. And the fact that they don't have what people here call Californication can be attributed to that law.
How are other cities now borrowing from the Portland model? And is it too late for them?
I don't know. I mean, I did a series a few years back called Who Owns the West, which looked at all the public land battles, which you know a lot about. And I've always been sort of interested in the soul of the West. And I thought the fight was always over, you know, the great 500 million acres that we all own, the public land. I've now sort of shifted my view a little bit. I think the fight is really over. Can people live somewhat in harmony in these cities next to wild nature? You know, when an acre goes into development, it never comes back. At least when an acre is logged, there's a chance that it'll grow back. So you look at California now again, to go back to the source of all this. And you have to live in the West, by the way, to appreciate how much people in the other cities really do despise California. Someone actually did a study recently that showed it's almost like Western racism is to look at California as the source of all evil. And all these new cities are just full of Californians who fled the Golden State because they think it no longer works. Well, right now in California, you have four cities that have voted just in the last year, including San Jose, to do exactly what Portland did. So not only is California coming out with these reports like Bank of America where they realize what their awful mistake was, they're now taking very strong measures to stop it in its tracks, to basically say, look, we're going to grow, but we're going to grow right in this given urban area. We're going to say, this is how we want the city to look. We want there to be a little open field where somebody can go for a walk 80 years from now.
Now, you mentioned highways as being part of the problem. That was it, a mile of highway creates four times the number.
Brings a fourfold increase in traffic. That's correct.
Yeah. Now, how has Portland handled highways? Are they a model for highway development, too?
Yeah. You know, the idea in the West has always been that people wouldn't really take to public transit because we all have our cars. And we all have, you know, I have a Jeep Cherokee. I'm as bad as anyone else. I like to have a four-wheel drive in the snow. But Portland took their traffic money. Instead of building new roads, they did this, again, this pretty radical thing. They went down and tore a freeway down. They just ripped the thing out. It went along the Willamette River, and that place where their freeway used to be is now called Tom McCall Park, and it's the most used park in all of Portland. Now, the other thing they did, and this is actually more important than Tom McCall Park, is they built this mass transit system, and it's called MAX, you know, has this cute little name like Tickle Me Elmo, and people come to Oregon and they say on a Saturday morning they want to go get on MAX as sort of a tourist thing. It's almost like this anomaly. Let's ride the cute little train into town. And ridership has gone far beyond what even the most optimistic people ever projected for this mass transit system. The other thing they did, which was radical, and they got sued on, but it's held up, they said, we're going to limit parking spaces. We're going to say you can't have any more than, say, just for a number, 20,000 parking spaces in all of downtown, period. And then they limited the size of stores, which is really unheard of. So instead of having these boxy mega stores, which is what they're trying to avoid, they have limited new retail stores in the suburban areas to 60,000 square feet, which is just a little bigger than Bill Gates' home. And they limited parking spaces, limited stores, they basically forced you to take their public transit system. If you can't find a place to park, you're going to take little Max, the little train, or you're going to take the bus system.
I guess I'm wondering what you see for the future, because the new Western cities that you're talking about are in many ways the cities of the future. They're the cities a lot of people look to see what the new cities are like or what the new cities will be like. So what kind of pattern are you seeing? What do you see when you look ahead?
This is a really hard thing for me to say because, I'm a third generation Westerner, and I love this region. I always think that that this is the, as Wallace Stegner said, the geography of hope is in the West, and I do believe that. But it's just stunning to see these cities go down the same path. So I wonder if, 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now, all of us journalists will be going back to Denver and going to Seattle to write the story about how they failed. The old idea was that America moved west, we reached the Pacific, we could go no more, so we sort of splashed back and we would force ourselves to build terrific cities because there was no other place to go. And I always thought, well, that would be the limiting factor. But in fact, it is not the limiting factor. So I guess what I see for the future are a series of city-states. I mean, it's already there. You're not going to strip these things away. I see these six regional powerhouses. They're all about 60 to 80 miles long. They all have these great new economies, but slowly, day by day, they're becoming bad places to live. And that may not mean something to a lot of people, but the fact of the matter is these cities were all built on the philosophy that it doesn't matter so much what you do at work as it does what you do after work. These are quality of life places. These are places where people go and have kayaks on their car rack and go mountain biking at 4 o'clock. And there's a serious subculture of lawyers turned carpenters.
Timothy Egan, he reports on the Pacific Northwest for the New York Times. He just started a 6-month leave of absence to complete a book. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, acres of dust and not a tree in sight. We talk with Jonathan Rabin about the immigrant homesteaders' experience in Montana at the turn of the century. What they found was often very different from what the brochures advertised. Rabin is the author of Bad Land. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews tenor saxophonist Ellery Eskelin's tribute to Gene Ammons. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. America has had a long romance with the West. Jonathan Rabin's new book, Badland, is about the homesteaders at the turn of the century who were lured from other countries to eastern Montana and the Dakotas by brochures that promised fertile farmland. What the homesteaders found instead was dry land and inhospitable winters. Some of their abandoned, ruined houses still dot the prairie. In fact, that's one of the things that drew Rabin to the homesteader's story. The New York Times called Badland one of the most illuminating books written about rural America in many years. Rabin is himself newly arrived in America. A few years ago, he moved to Seattle from England. I asked him why he's so interested in these wrecks of houses and in the homesteaders of the early 1900s.
I came out west and felt myself to be short of roots and reasons to be here, and started exploring how other Europeans had landed up seeking a home in the United States, and these just seemed a paradigmatic example, really, of Europeans coming out their heads full of American dreams, trying to make a home for themselves in a strange land. And gosh, that land itself is about as strange as you can get.
What is strange about the land that you're writing about?
It's treeless, it's bare. It's a land of shale and sagebrush and dry coulees and low buttes. It's a land that doesn't resemble anything that you could find in Europe. I mean, this is the northern plains, on more or less on the state line between North Dakota and Montana, eastern Montana, western North Dakota. And it was advertised to the people who came there as a new Arcadia. Presented in pamphlets issued by the railroads as this green and fertile land where anyone, you didn't even need to be a farmer to do it, could realize an American dream of prosperity as an independent farmer.
When you were driving around eastern Montana, did you find a lot of abandoned homes and abandoned little towns?
Oh, it's a landscape of ruins. The dead vastly outnumber the living there. And you look across this great oceanic sweep of empty prairie, and most of the signs of human habitation are of houses long, long abandoned, some of them sinking straight back into the soil, some of them still standing, I mean, to the point where you can walk in through their front doors and find clothes in the closet and almost the remains of the last meal on the kitchen table.
Tell us a little bit more about what you found inside some of these abandoned homes.
Well, it really started with my friend and I searching for the remains of the homestead that his grandfather had set up in 1910, and he'd never been back to it. And we mounted a little expedition from Seattle and went out to find the site of the homestead. There was practically nothing left. Things scattered in the grass. The house and outbuildings had gone. We found a few objects, like his father's sled, or the remains of what had once been his father's sled, bits out of a Model T Ford, a milking bucket, that kind of thing. And then we found the remains of the bonfire left by the family when they finally quit in 1926. And I pulled out from this blackened earth a little silver medallion. I didn't know what it was. It was the head of what looked like a Greek goddess. I think now probably Mnemosyne, the goddess of memory. And I handed it to Mike and asked him to figure out what it was. He turned it over in his fingers and he said, "I know what this is. It's the clasp to an old-timey photograph album. They must have burned the family photos when they left." And I found that extraordinarily poignant as a thought, that these people simply could not bear to take away from the prairie the memory of the hope, the optimism, the smiling photographs that they brought to it.
The homesteading boom started in 1909 after Congress passed the Homesteading Act. Tell us what the Act had to say.
Well, the Act basically enlarged the size of the basic homestead in semi-arid lands, which is a kind of euphemism, from 160 acres to 320 acres. 320 acres is half a square mile of land. And it looked, at the time, munificent.
And the railroad companies really wanted settlers to come and become homesteaders. The railroad companies needed people living along the railroad lines if the railroad lines were going to succeed, so they really had a vested interest in homesteading. And you write about some of the advertising literature, the brochures that the railroad companies published to entice people from America and from abroad to come settle places like eastern Montana. Would you describe some of these ads and brochures?
Well, they were works of grand romantic fiction. They were written by copywriters, I imagine, who worked in offices in New York and Chicago, who themselves had never set eyes on the prairie of eastern Montana. They were illustrated partly by line drawings, in which the artists were wonderfully fanciful about what the landscape might contain. They drew in trees when there were no trees. They drew in fields and hedges and all sorts of things. Also by photographs, which were taken not very far away from the free land that was on offer, but they weren't actually photographs of free land. And they painted this Arcadian picture of the riches of the land, its fertile soil, its beneficent climate. And people fell basically for a landscape in a book. When they finally arrived in eastern Montana, very often after a transatlantic voyage and a long and exhausting railway trip from New York out to the west, they found themselves the proud proprietors of 320 acres of treeless dust.
Why don't you describe how, for instance, the climate was described in some of the railroad advertising brochures and what the climate really turned out to be like?
Oh, the railroad brochures minimized the cold, and the cold there was and is intense, often sinking to minus 40 Fahrenheit, which people suffered in tar paper shacks. You know, these makeshift little houses that they built for themselves for their first winter on the prairie. And the brochures maximized the amount of rainfall. In fact, you know, 15 inches, I think, is taken as the sort of real measure of where arable land really becomes arable. And they played up the amount of rainfall that was falling on the prairie. In actual fact, what was coming down was probably 11, 12, 13 inches on average. But the brochures made much of the fact not only that there was sufficient rain to make this soil yield wheat and barley and those other things, but also they had this wonderful sort of pseudoscience that they were promoting. Rain follows the plough, rain follows settlement, and rain especially follows the railroad. They dug up Louis Agassiz's son, another Professor Agassiz, who came up with this splendid theory, which is that if you drive a locomotive fast enough through the landscape, some kind of electromagnetic something or other takes place in the atmosphere, and rain clouds miraculously form over the passing train in the landscape, so that the railroads themselves were bringing rain to the dry prairie. And all this, of course, was poppycock. But the settlers didn't know that as they read the brochures.
Wow, I think the guy who wrote that tried to sell me a car once.
I think he sold me one, actually.
Well, you found something called Campbell's Soil Culture Manual. Why don't you describe that?
Oh, that was the Bible of the dry farming movement. And every settler, you know, there were probably three books in these people's claim shacks when they started out. One would be the Bible, one would be Pilgrim's Progress, and one would be Campbell's Soil Culture Manual of 1907. Campbell was this Scottish Presbyterian who had an experimental farm in Nebraska, from where he promulgated his wonderful theories about, and they were a mixture of science and Calvinism, really, how you could turn the driest land into a reservoir of water which would see you through the dry years. If you managed to Calvinistically hoard and save every single drop of rain that fell whenever rain did fall. And he had his patent subsurface packer, his patent plows and harrows and discs, and he believed in capillary attraction as being the great force that could be harnessed by the homesteader to make his dry land moist. And that, too, didn't really amount to much as science, but it was science's miracle, which so much of the settler's science was. Science believed in as a kind of religion that if you could understand the scientific principles of something like capillary attraction, you'd be saved and the desert could be made to bloom and turn into a garden.
So, great, we have a combination of advertising hype and pseudoscience.
We do. And, of course, pseudoscience was believed in. Almost as a kind of a religion, you know, the miracles of science, and the miracles of science, one of which was the turning of dry land into the garden, were very much like, you know, biblical miracles. It was like the feeding of the 5,000. And people looked at now, when you go to the prairie now, you look at the way in which that landscape is dominated by ruined schoolhouses. You don't see church spires or church towers as you might see back east or in Europe. You see these gaunt, windowless schoolhouses, one to every hill. And they remind you that this was a secular society, a utopian society, a society that believed that education and science would be the making of it. And I think they are a reminder of how much people believe, very often credulously and innocently, in the claims of science and the claims of man's knowledge and man's capacity to dominate nature. Because, of course, for the homesteading experiment to work at all, man had to have conquered nature. And in 1910, people really believed that that had happened, I think.
My guest is Jonathan Rabin, author of the new book, Bad Land. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jonathan Rabin, author of the new book, Bad Land, about the homesteaders who were lured to eastern Montana in the early 1900s. A lot of homesteaders eventually gave up. They couldn't make a go of it. It was too cold in winter. It was too dry in summer. The life was just too hard, too much isolation. What do you know of some of the turning points for settlers who gave up?
Oh, it was a combination of weather and credit, I think, that did for most people, because they happened to arrive in a rare run of relatively moist years, and it looked for an instant as if the great experiment was going to pay off, that they were going to build this utopian society on the prairie. Their crops sprouted, the wheat came up, their cattle fattened. And between about 1910 and 1915, there was a sort of giddy sense that everything was working. The science was proving its magic. And they built their schools. They formed themselves into communities. Those who couldn't speak English learned their English. They knitted themselves into a kind of rural society, very, very much like a European farm community, really. And then two things got them. One was the change in the weather, in which Montana reverted to its usual character, which was distressingly cold winters and very, very dry springs and summers. And the other was actually caused by their success, because as they seemed to be succeeding, so it became the season of the smiling bank manager. And bank managers roamed the prairie in Model T Fords, offering cheap loans to buy farm machinery to the homesteaders. 5.5% buy up, you know, go off, buy a tractor, buy a baler, buy a combined harvester, and you know, triple, quadruple your output. You know, this thing will pay for itself within a couple of seasons. And the homesteaders then got themselves into monthly payments, and monthly payments that as soon as the weather changed, they were unable to meet. So it was this combination of terrible weather and those brown envelopes with windows in them that are the nightmares of everybody.
Did you come from the kind of family that ever picked up and moved when you were young? Is that kind of movement a part of your formative experience?
Yes, it was, and it was a very un-English thing, I think. My family was almost totally peripatetic. Every couple of years, we seemed to be picking up sticks and trying to set down roots in a new place. My father was, first of all, when I was born in 1942, he was an army officer, and then he worked for a voluntary organization for a couple of years after the war, and then he became a theological student, and then he became a curate and a priest, moving from parish to parish. And I found myself, you know, no sooner had I put down roots in a place, started getting to know people at a school, I was moving on, and very often from the remote countryside to a quite big city, to a suburb, to a small town, and so on. So I was getting to see a lot of different societies, but always really as an outsider, as a stranger looking in. And just about at the time in which I began to feel that we were at home there, suddenly we weren't. And I think that's a terribly good training, really, for a writer.
Your father was an Anglican clergyman. And I'm wondering if you were interested in the different forms of religion you found in your research on the prairie.
Oh, yes, very much so. I grew up listening to my father arguing over the dinner table about theology. And I think it sharpened, which he always called the queen of the sciences. And I found myself in later life, though I am not a believer, fascinated by the kinds of theological ideas that people dream up for themselves in order to make sense of their lives, in particular landscapes. Mm-hmm. And on the prairie, I was fascinated by the way in which that early belief in science, in man, in secular society, seemed to give way at some point under the impact of the weather, of poverty, of failure, to a moving from one Bible of dry farming, which was Campbell's Soil Culture Manual, to another book, the Book of Revelation, where in some ways the hideous climate of eastern Montana was far more accurately described than ever it was in the railroad pamphlets or in Campbell's Manual. And watching the growth on the prairie of fundamentalist Christianity, one could see that those beliefs have a sort of natural geographic location in somewhere like eastern Montana, where the extremities of the weather find, you know, perfect correlatives in the descriptions of the weather in the Book of Revelation. You know, the giant hailstones, the plagues of locusts, which, of course, on the prairie were plagues, hideous plagues of grasshoppers, which ate the homesteaders' crops. The lightning storms, the sense of being alone under the sky with, you know, exposed to the vengeful gaze of God above, I think is a very powerful idea in that landscape. And you can see, I think, exactly how these people who in 1910 had been burbling about the efficacy of science came by the 1920s and 30s, many of them, to believe not in science at all, but in fundamentalist Christianity.
Jonathan Rabin is the author of Badland. Here's guitarist Bill Frisell's interpretation of Aaron Copland's The Open Prairie. Thank you. Coming up, a new CD by jazz saxophonist Ellery Eskelin paying tribute to Gene Ammons. This is Fresh Air. Tenor saxophonist Gene Ammons was the son of boogie-woogie piano specialist Albert Ammons. Tenor saxophonist Ellery Eskelin is the son of a jazz organ player mother and of pop music cult figure Rod Keith, one of the people who used to advertise in the back of comic books that he'd set your poems to music for a small fee. Ellery recently talked with us about his father's music. Ellery Eskelin has a new CD, which is a tribute to Gene Ammons. It's called The Sun Died. That's S-U-N. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
That's Ellery Eskelin on tenor saxophone with Mark Rebo on guitar. They're playing Jungle Soul from Eskelin's CD of tunes written or recorded by Gene Ammons. Ammons was one of the kings of soulful organ group jazz. He was also from Chicago and steeped in that city's blues traditions from childhood. Ellery Eskelin is as avant-garde as anybody in jazz these days, turning the old forms inside out or stripping them down to the skeleton. For him to do an Ammons tribute may strike you as a little forced, in theory at least. Sounds good, though. Ellery Eskelin was raised in Baltimore, where any young musician who wanted to sit in at a jam session at the Jazz Closet or Sportsman's Lounge had better know some soulful blues numbers. Maybe that's why he has a lot of the attributes of a soul tenor, a big, pliant sound, and a swaggering rhythm to kick himself along no matter what the rhythm section is doing. Even so, drummer Kenny Wallison can play those heavy backbeats without sounding like a metronome. Guitar hero Mark Rebo, who's played with Tom Waits and Elvis Costello, among many others, is one of those downtown New York musicians who sometimes prides himself on his lack of groove. But as you've already heard, he's right in the pocket here. The idea of making what amounts to an organ group record without an organ is a nice idea, too. Having Rebo use blues guitar distortion and organ-like electronic effects is a smart compromise. Thank you. Of course, that's Canadian Sunset, which was a minor hit for Gene Ammons in 1960. One could argue that this set of earthy jazz tunes with a rock and roll beat, distorted chords, and overblown tenor reminds us that for all the high-flown jazz talk about elegant instrumental diction and the majesty of the blues, jazz has a cruder and more direct side as well. But maybe the best thing about Ellery Eskelin's CD, The Sun Died, which is on the Soul Note label, is that it doesn't sound like it's trying to score ideological points. Huh. Jazz without polemics. We could use more of that.
Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead is in Amsterdam writing a book on Dutch jazz. He reviewed Ellery Eskelin's new CD, The Sun Died. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Alan Tu, with Tracy Tannenbaum and Barbara Bogave, research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from The People vs. Larry Flint, a Milos Forman film now at theaters everywhere. This is NPR, National Public Radio.